So your first selection, what's the title and briefly, what's the book about?
The title is The Devil in the White City. It's by Eric Larson, and it is a parallel story of the construction of the World's Fair in Chicago in 1893 and a serial killer at large who was building this strange house of death. And so there were these two concurrent buildings going on.
What specifically about that book appealed to you?
I mean, the book for me really was, for me as a writer, kind of a transformative encounter, because although I now write history, I had never been a big reader of history or thought about history. I'd done a lot of reporting, and I thought if I was going to write something more literary or longer, it would have to be a novel. And this for me was really this eye-opener of the truth really, really is stranger than fiction. And that you can take all of the skills of reporting and researching and apply that to telling that truth and making it really compelling.
And Eric Larson was a journalist. And I have to wonder, do you think journalists have an advantage in writing history that's entertaining?
Absolutely. I mean, I read a lot of history now, and people who come from a journalism background kind of know digging around and looking for details and telling storytelling and bringing those kind of really compelling specifics to mind. They're not worried about using big elaborate words like academics might bring to it. So, I mean, obviously an academic has the perspective of historical research methods and they know what to draw on, which, I mean, for me, I had to go back and re-educate myself. And I went back to graduate school while I was working on my first book, which really was fantastically helpful. But I think journalists just really bring that digging that gets that human element in there. I definitely found that book really compelling, Devil in the White City, because it also dealt with the dynamics of a city. And as someone who writes about a city and has worked in city magazines, and that's my passion as a subject, that way of telling the story of what was happening in Chicago and the movers and the shakers and putting that kind of urban planning thing into such a compelling narrative was really moving. So if we think about it right now, what we're looking at, all the stadium construction happening in Atlanta and the movers and shakers behind that and how do those dynamics work out, you see things haven't really changed that much in history. So we have a lot to learn from it.
Yeah, and you wrote a piece in the Atlanta magazine last past summer on
yeah, so we like
the alleged deal around Turner Field.
It would be arrogant of me to say it's the definitive backstory of Turner Field, but other people have said that, so I'll take their word for it. But yes, and my story on Turner Field went back to the 1860s when the Summerhill neighborhood was first deeded for freed slaves and then also relegated for Jews who moved to Atlanta. So you kind of have this history, but you don't really understand what's happening in Turner Field now if you don't go all the way back to 1865.
What's second on your list?
Well, it's really, first of all, let me just say it's really, really hard to narrow down to three. I spent a lot of time agonizing over picking three books because it was like, do these have to be my three absolute all-time favorite books? Are they like things that reflect on a worldview? It's really challenging. Three is a tough number to narrow it down. But I wanted to bring a work of fiction that really spoke to me on a very personal level. So the second book is Barbara Kingsolver's The Poisonwood Bible, which, if you're not familiar, it's a novel about a family that goes to Congo in 1959. The father is a Baptist minister, and there are four daughters. And they have a lot of culture clash between their belief system, what they encounter in the Congo. I don't want to give away the ending in case people haven't read it, but it's compelling and tragic, and the way the four daughters respond to that experience is really telling. And the book speaks to me particularly because my parents are missionaries. A lot of people don't know what it's like being a missionary child. And although my parents went into the mission field later and they went to a different part of the world, I think this book really captures the missionary kid experience, that kind of sense of being thrown into this new culture, being part of this missionary compulsion, mission, drive that as a kid you may or may not buy into. And I have three sisters, so I come from a family of four daughters, which is the same as in the book. And I have two sisters who are twins, and they're twins in the book. And the four of us had very different experiences, although we were the four daughters of the same missionary parents. I think when the four of us talk, we all think we are different ages and our different things were going on. So we had these very different experiences around this common theme of cross-culture and cross-belief. And there are a couple just really compelling details. So the family in the book, the Price family, leaves from Bethlehem, Georgia, to go to the Congo, and they pack what they think they need, including all these Betty Crocker cake mixes, because they want to prepare ahead to celebrate. But then they get there, and they're in the humidity and the climate, and none of the things work, and they can't bake any of those. And when I was young, we were in India, and my grandmother would mail us Betty Crocker cake mixes, frosting, because everyone had heard missionaries want to get this taste of home. And so the first time that she sent a package, the cake mix came, and the frosting had been opened, and someone had obviously put a spoon in to sample it. And then the next year, she sent it again, and the cake mix had been slashed open, and it was chocolate frosting, and the entire can had been eaten. So just this detail of that. And then the other thing is they drink Carnation instant milk all the time, which we also did in the mission field, and I cannot drink milk to this day because of that experience.
The title of the book, The Poisonwood Bible, what is that?
So it comes from a cultural misunderstanding where there is a phrase that the father is supposed to say, which is Jesus's love, and it's a word in the language that they speak in this particular village. But if you say it with a certain inflection, it means that Jesus is poison wood, which is this deadly plant. And so it's this idea of misunderstanding or interpreting the Bible of how you go about it. Barbara Kingsolver is a naturalist and comes from that kind of background. So there was always a lot of botany and plants and those kinds of things woven into the story.
I got to think the poison wood Bible would have been a slam dunk for you. I mean, that it has had quite an impact on you.
It certainly did, and it really speaks to it. I mean, part of it is this is a personal part of my life that I don't always talk about. Being a missionary is such an unusual occupation, and it's fraught with all kinds of meaning. So for a while, my sister and I used to just tell people, oh, we grew up outside of Indianapolis. And then no one would ask us any further questions because it was like, well, that's boring. And then I moved to Indianapolis and I could no longer get away with that story. So I finally started embracing and kind of talking about it a little bit.
Your next choice that you brought in.
I was thinking about what choice to bring in to talk about writing history and thinking about history. And for me, it's really, really important to capture the original voices of people who are in the stories and to also look for a very broad spectrum of voices. So this book is called Georgia, History Written by Those Who Lived It, and it's published by the Beehive Foundation, which is in Savannah. What it is just a compilation of primary source materials that trace the history of Georgia from the very early founding of the colony in Savannah, the frontier days, the settlement, the Trail of Tears, the creation of Atlanta, the Civil War, up through around the beginning of the modern civil rights era. And there are just so many voices that come in that range from James Oglethorpe, the original governor and founder of Georgia, but also you hear from former slaves, you hear from women, there are letters. It just really kind of speaks to that experience of being part of history and how you shape it. And parts of it are very sad and serious, and parts of it are very funny, and you learn things you did not know. So one of the things I came across, which I really thought was fascinating, was the origin of the word cracker. This also speaks to the fact of part of my family is from Georgia, and they came over in the 1700s, and they definitely would have fallen into that cracker or white trash class more than an upper class. And so this is a French journalist called Louis Milfort who toured the state of Georgia when it was still the Creek Nation, actually, when it was still being settled and only part of Georgia was Georgia. I just wanted to read this because it really kind of gets at that slice of history, which is maybe not what you think of with the Gone with the Wind mythologizing of the old Southern culture. So here's what he writes. These crackers are very fond of liquor when they drink some of it, since they are by nature quarrelsome and mean. And then it goes on to talk about how the custom was to never cut your fingernails and to make them very, very tough. Now I'm quoting again. They smear them with tallow and hold them in front of the fire. The tallow makes the nails extremely hard. I've seen some which are as hard and dangerous as the claws of a lion. And then it goes on to talk about how eye gouging was a big portion of this fighting. And at one point, there were parts of Georgia where 1 in 4 of every man had no eyes.
Yikes. And the Atlanta Crackers baseball team would be,
yeah, so who knew,
would
right?
be shocked if yeah. they knew that was the origin. Yeah. To have a collection of just selected primary source materials on this on the history of Georgia is really, really cool. And that book itself goes back. It's not a new publication.
It's a reprint of a publication. It was edited by Mills Lane, who is a historian but also a banker here in Georgia. So it's reprinted, and I think it is a great way for someone who is not a history reader to read the history of Georgia, because you're not reading a traditional history book, but you're hearing about these stories and you connect and you really relate to it. So if there was someone who didn't really think they ever wanted to sit down and read a history of the state, this would be the book I would completely endorse, because it's so engaging. But there are also just these heartbreaking accounts of both Civil War experiences and also slavery. And this is from John Brown, who was a slave born in Virginia, and he was also partly enslaved in Georgia. And the part of it that is so chilling is when he talks about how he's sold. And so this is what he writes in his account of slave life in Georgia. "My master called me up and offered to sell me. I was then about 10 years of age, and after some chaffering about terms, Finney agreed to purchase me by the pound. After I'd been weighed, the price I was sold for amounted to about $310. Finney paid the money and I marched off. I look around and saw my poor mother stretching out her hands after me. She ran up and overtook us, but Finney, who is a large, tall fellow, between me and my mother, would not let her approach, though she begged and prayed to be allowed to kiss me for the last time. My heart was bursting. We got to the gate, and I turned round to see whether I could not get a chance of kissing my mother. She made a dart forward to meet me, but Finney gave me a hard push, which sent me spinning through the gate. He then slammed it shut in my mother's face. That was the last time I ever saw her." And it was just such a compelling, heartbreaking account from the agony of being separated by his mother when he was 10, and then the absolute inhumanity and humiliation of being weighed and being sold by the pound, and just thinking of that very matter-of-fact brutality. There's also a very interesting chapter, Frederick Law Olmsted, who most of us know as the landscaper of Central Park. He also factors into the Devil in the White City book. His firm and his children were involved in landscaping Piedmont Park and Druid Hills. He traveled through Georgia and made these kind of scientific botanical studies of slave life and plantation life and how they were managed. And it's very clinical, and it's really chilling. And it's something that I had no clue about his life and his history. And it really gave me a second thought as I thought about his legacy and what he thinks, because it was just very kind of the way he noted plants and how things were maintained. And then he also just noticed how many slave owners fed their slaves bacon versus grits versus something else, and how they were kind of kept and taken care of or not taken care of. It's really kind of mind-blowing.
Very clinical, very objective, yes. Very scientific.
Yes, just like his naturalist notebooks about kind of uncovering other things, but he also did this with people.
You've written about events in our city's history that are very transformative. You did a book on the race riot of 1906, the burial of Martin Luther King, the funeral of Martin Luther King Jr., and your newest book. What are you working on now?
I am working on a book about the 1917 fire in Atlanta, and you're absolutely right. The common theme of what I have written about is kind of pivotal change experiences in Atlanta, and how did Atlanta react to change or a crisis, really, is responding to a crisis. So the 1917 fire, which not a lot of people know about, destroyed a large segment of Atlanta. It really kind of transformed in-town Atlanta, and it destroyed more property than Sherman's fire, which is the better-known fire. So the title is The Second Burning of Atlanta.
Although that fact is not going to get any forgiveness for William T. Sherman, is it?
It will not, but it was a very big fire, and it's a very dramatic story. And Asa Candler, the president of Coca-Cola, was mayor at the time, and he drove out in his own car to get dynamite, to help dynamite houses, to create a fire break. And so although it was a real crisis experience for Atlanta, it's much more exciting and more of an adventure story than my first two books, which dealt with very, very serious, very intense subject matter. So although it certainly was serious and there was great property damage, there's a more of an adventure story element to it. And I'm very excited because I found these women who were part of the relief effort and were driving cars to help, which was very scandalous. So my big thing of looking at documents for all of the books has been really to look at the sources that historians don't go to. So I love to read gossip columns from old newspapers, because that's where you find out what women were doing, because women weren't covered in the other news. So I found a lot of information about that, and so I've been poring over those to get the story of these women.
Rebecca Burns, author and journalist, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.